Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. As always, we love talking properties, and I know Jazz has got a spin-off on his own Bitcoin, which is also creating a huge success on his side. But look, today we want to cover property again, just because it is the bread and butter of a lot of Australians in terms of how they create wealth. And given that the current COVID environment is, you know, it's kind of starting to ease down, which is good, but the economic impact is still going to be here. And I feel like there's still a bit of more pain to be felt. And on that note, that's why I thought, you know, we want to bring up someone who's an authority in this in the property industry, of course, and has been in this game for a long time. And we actually had the honor of getting him on last year. We had Chris Gray from Your Empire coming on last year, which had a good insight on, you know, what sort of property to invest in and so on. And now we thought we'll bring him back on today again to show us what his thoughts are in relation to post-COVID environment in a property sense. So without any further ado, Chris, how are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show, Chris. What are your thoughts on the property market currently? And do we see it performing like it has always in the past in terms of the capital gains?
Sure. So I think the main thing to start off with is, first of all, there's multiple property markets. So you could be in a market that's absolutely going on fire, and there could be other people that are going through absolute hell. So a lot of it depends on both the geography, so where you are in Australia or around the world, and obviously price point and things like that as well. The other point to make before we get into things is about the media as well. We all know that the shows kind of need to sell themselves based on big headlines, the current affair, today, tonight type things, 60 minutes. And we're all aware of what happens with that. And then I guess talking about the Steve Keens while we're there and the Harry Dents, again, a lot of those guys, the reason they get a lot of coverage is because they're saying stuff that's really out there. And from my experience of 10 years on Sky News is the media believe that they've got to give a balanced story. And so if someone's obviously positive, they need to find a negative person. And if people like the Steves are, and nothing against him, and he's cleverer than me, I don't understand all his economics and the rest of it to prove him right or wrong. But the bottom line is, if he's always got that story of 30 or 40%, he's always going to get media coverage. And that's obviously selling the papers and stuff. So look, on the property market, everyone knows it's a long-term game. And so the main thing in property is you need to be cashed up at all times, so you're never forced to sell. Because if you're never forced to sell, you never trigger that loss. And so I always say, my mum's been in the same house for 45 years over in the UK. She hasn't got a mortgage. She would be, the market would have gone up and down in the last 45 years. She wouldn't have even noticed because she's never gone through refinance or selling or anything like that. And this is why property is stable, because the average person wants to keep the roof over their head. The first thing they always pay is their mortgage, and the banks will not kick people out of their homes unless they really have to. And that's the great thing about property, it's stable. Yep. So my expertise is more around the blue chip markets, especially around kind of Sydney and then a bit more kind of Melbourne, Brisbane. Generally, most of that medium price market, there's no stock. There's never any stock. People aren't forced to sell. They've got 6 month mortgage holidays. They've got super low interest rates. Even though rents are down, the rent is still very, very close to the mortgage rate. So the negative gearing's not that much. So people don't need to sell.
Right. So, but Chris, with the this work from home concept that has come out as a part of the COVID situation, do you see that the inner CBD or the middle ring of the areas kind of getting a little bit more affected over the long run? Because people, if they can work from home, why would they want to be close to the CBD areas? I mean, they will probably prefer country areas where they can find properties much cheaper and don't have to pay those much rents or the prices that they pay in the CBD areas.
Sure. So look, COVID's really affected us for 2 months. And everyone, the classic thing is, oh, we can all work from home, so no one's going to go into work anymore. People will go back to work. Sure, there's an argument to say, why would you pay for all that commercial space if you don't need to and people can work from home? But depending on if you've got a husband, a wife or kids, there's a lot of people dying to go back to work. And I think the divorce rate is up. I think the domestic violence is up. I reckon there's a lot of people that can't wait to get back into the office. Another counter argument is a lot of the commercial offices are saying, before we used to cram people into X amount of square meters, now with social distancing, they need 2X square meters. So you're actually going to need more commercial space, even if you've got people working from home. And so there's all these different strategies and ideas. No one knows what's going to happen. So rather than panic, and just because we've got COVID or just because we've been working from home for two months, doesn't mean the world's going to change over the long term. So I still think a lot of people still will go to work. A lot of people say, I mean, I talk about Bondi Beach just because everyone knows about it wherever you are around the world. A lot of people still want to hang by the beach. They don't want to be 2 hours from Sydney, maybe. So if they've got the money, I think they'll still live in those kind of places.
Okay, interesting. And how about the rental market? Do you see the rental market getting affected in any shape and form?
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, it is potentially down. If you're renting apartments out now or houses and you're by the beach in the middle of winter, in the middle of COVID, it's going to be tougher than the middle of summer without COVID. But the thing I always go back to is I came to Australia in the late 90s, and that was in the days of 5% yields. So where $500 a week rent meant the property was worth 500 grand. But the mortgages were around 7 or 8%, so you were losing 2 or 3%. Whereas everyone says rents are really low now, and rents are roughly, say, in the good areas, say 3, 3.5%. But what's our mortgage rate? Our mortgage rate is potentially 2.5, 3 for some people. So potentially it's positive cash flow on a gross rent perspective. Still negative after your expenses and stuff like that. But effectively, the gap between the rent and the mortgage is the smallest it's ever been, which means it's the most affordable it's ever been. So again, people just think rents are down, that's bad, but mortgage rates have crashed more than rents.
The style of purchasing that your Empire Agency had in the past remains the same even post-COVID. So nothing has changed on that front. You guys are still buying similar kind of properties.
Yeah, so I've bought the same thing since 22. I'm 49 now, so for 27 years, nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is the price point. So I was buying at 200 grand at 22. In 99, when I came to Australia, I was buying at 360. Now we're paying $1.5 million. And so the main difference is in February, a good two-bedroom unit was selling, say, if you got a bank valuation of $1 million, which is conservative, that would sell at auction on a good day at $1,050,000 or 1.1, so 5 or 10% overvaluation because of the demand and lack of supply. Now that same property is probably selling for $9,950,000. So for us, we were paying $1 million, so we say maybe the market's 5 or 10% off. For the emotional buyer at auction that was paying 1.1, it's potentially 10 or 20% off. But I don't think that's a market crash. I don't think it's a drop in the market. It's a temporary window. And just like we saw after the election last year, prices bounced back from their 18 and 19 drop almost instantaneously. And so I don't know when COVID will come to an end for the property market. It could be in a month or two. It could be 6, 12, 18 months. But I think good property, short supply, will bounce back to whatever the peak was in 1920 or even 2017 fairly quickly.
So what you're saying is basically the blue chip property markets, the ones that you're monitoring at the moment, are taking a temporary dip, but it's not going to be a longer term. You know, whenever that recovers and, you know, when we really walk out of the COVID panic and the aftereffect. But how would the unemployment figures at the moment, that's going to impact on that basis? I mean, we know the unemployment figures are high. In realistic terms, probably closer to the two digits if we put aside JobKeeper, really. So how would that impact the middle and the inner ring from a longer term perspective?
Sure. So I don't think it will that much. And look, I'm not an economist like a Steve Keen or anything like that. Sure. I guess my skill base is being on the street and being an accountant and taking all the emotion away and seeing what physically happens when we have GFCs and things like that. And so we're buying up to 50 or 100 properties a year. We've had 500 or 600 properties under management. So we're in touch with what's going on the street. So I think most of the unemployment, again, a large part of that, I think, will bounce back in time as we all go back into work and go and take up normal life again. But I think most of the people in those areas aren't unemployed. And one of the biggest learnings I've had from Sky News, so I've done Sky News for 10 years, interviewed probably 400 or 500 people like ResidX, CoreLogic, RP Data, all those kind of guys. The head of research of ResidX, which predicts capital growth, was a guy called John Edwards, who's now retired. And we always had the discussion on Sky, which is keeping up with inflation. So how can people still afford these property prices and how do they keep going up? And he said there's various factors like our parents used to have one income, big family house. Now we live in smaller properties. We've got two incomes. We've got lower interest rates, all this kind of stuff. But he said the overriding economic rule is supply and demand. If you're in an area where there is no more property, which the inner ring three-story high limits there isn't, and you're surrounded by people with money that have got good jobs, they've got rich parents, the rich parents are giving their kids a couple of hundred grand as a deposit or paying cash for the property. If there's no more supply of property and people want to live there, prices go up. And I, from doing basic economics at school and accounting, I believe in that. So we're not talking Point Piper $50, $100 million properties. $1 million, depending on your view, is around Australia, they might be buying 500 grand homes. And so $1 million is a lot of money. But in Sydney, in Bondi or Manly or Neutral Bay or Kirribilli, $1 million is affordable for young people. Because $1 million mortgage now at 3% is 30 grand a year. And so what's that? 700 bucks a week or something like that? 650 bucks a week. People can afford it. And so as long as they can get the deposit, and I'm sure we'll have some more first home buyer schemes and stuff like that. To me, that's still an affordable market, which is why still people are paying a lot of money to get in those suburbs.
How about the foreign buyer market?
So we deal with more the expat market. So people with Australian passports but are living overseas. And so again, is when we had, we've had a number of crises with Asia where exchange rates or they're banned from buying or whatever else. And everyone always says, oh, what are you doing? And I'm saying there isn't anyone buying in the markets we're buying at because typically foreigners have to buy brand new. And so, and they don't want the beach necessarily. And all the feng shui and all of that stuff that they're into, they don't like an old crappy building that's been around for 50 years that lots of people have been in and maybe people have died in. They want brand spanking new, never touched. And under Foreign Investment Review Board, FIRB, most foreigners have got to buy brand new. So they're not buying that. And because they live in Hong Kong, Singapore, China, they're used to high towers. And that's what they automatically buy, which is the Meriton-type things or Crown. And they're buying in Green Square or all those kind of places. So if I was in those markets, sure, I'd be terrified. And especially with all the stuff we had about the buildings, was it... Mascot Towers, yeah. And the other tower.
Opal Tower.
So that's a big market to worry about. But I used to joke on Sky News with Tom Panos, and who's a real estate trainer, and Charles Tarby. Charles is Lebanese. Tom's Greek. I used to be English. And so I said, well, if we all went to an auction, if the papers really wanted to say it, they said there's a Leb, there's a Greek, and there's a Pom, all these foreigners buying Australian property. But technically, we're Aussies. So just because someone looks Asian doesn't mean they're a foreigner.
Fair point. Yeah. No, that's cool. We know commercial is not an area that you deal in a lot, right? But any thoughts on commercial property? That, do you see that changing as a part of COVID? There's a lot of talk about that.
Yeah. So again, I'm not an expert, but again, we've covered it a reasonable amount of time. So, again, that's the scare. But where there's a scare, there's an opportunity. So with residential property, generally it's always valued based on comparable sales. So what other properties in the street have sold for a similar price? And it's pretty stable because $1 million property doesn't have a share market scare and it's suddenly 500 grand. Generally, commercial property is valued based on the cap rates, which basically means the future income stream. and the market generates a cap rate, and that's how they value the future income streams. So typically what's happened in the GFC and other recessions is overnight that the market panics and they suddenly devalue it. And so commercial could still get valued at half the amount it was before, even if the same tenant is in there paying the same rent and nothing else has really changed. So what we've got is now is a double up, because suddenly, sure, they've still got commercial leases, but the tenants aren't paying the rent. And so that would be very, very scary for the market. But again, is where there's a scare and there's an automatic devaluation, almost like the share market straight away, that can be a great opportunity to buy.
But do you see the domino effect on the residential market for that, or not at all?
No, I think generally residential and commercial investors are separate. So I don't think people necessarily move money from one market to the other. Generally, in the big end of town, in the city, they always see residential as mum and dad, and it's amateur kind of stuff, which I like, and I'm happy that the big end of town isn't in residential to play with the market. And so, again, with commercial, generally you need more money. There's higher leverage. There's higher interest rate costs. You could have properties untenanted for 1 or 2 years. And really, a lot of the value in turning commercial is getting a property that's got no tenant and is maybe run down and almost has zero value, and then doing the block up, making it up to all the neighbours and their 5 or 6 star ratings, and then putting a blue chip tenant in there on a long term lease, and suddenly you could double your money overnight, effectively. But again, it's not for the amateur residential investors. It's a big money game. And there's a lot of risk, and so you need to know what you're doing.
Okay. We had a couple of investors on the show recently, and including Peter Koulizos. I'm sure you know him.
He's coming on my show next week.
Yeah. And including myself to some extent, we've said a few times now, and these investors, that passive investing is not going to work as strongly as it used to work in the past. If you're looking for a capital growth, it's more of active investing that's required, like renovations, what you were talking just before, kind of thing. Do you think that's right? Or passive investing, if you leave it for 8 to 10 years, bought in the right suburb, will still work? You'll still see the same kind of growth.
I'm hoping it's still going to be the same, because I'm lazy. I don't want to work for a living. I like traveling the world. I like driving cars and going out having fun. I don't want to be an active investor. And so, sure, we renovate properties, but I still think it's the long-term buy and hold, based on what I said about Residex, lack of supply, strong demand. I think more people will still do that. To give you an example, we've got a couple of clients at the moment. One sold some family farms. They're putting 10 million cash into the eastern suburbs, Lone or Shore Inner West. Zero debt. They're retiring, and effectively the rent they're going to live off. So if you think, even if you get 2% rent, it's still a couple of hundred grand, or 3% rent. And they're going to give that for future generations. So that's $10 million. So that's roughly eight properties, which will never go on the market again in the next 10 or 20 years. That's out of the stock pool. We've got other clients that have got tens of millions. Not all our clients are like that. Some are just buying 750 grand units. But there's a lot of people that are cashed up that just long-term buy and hold, and they're Australian families, and they're just land banking decent properties for a long time.
So according to Chris Gray, property should still double every 8 to 10 years, kind of thing.
Look, hopefully. It depends which 8 to 10 years you look at. And being an accountant, I know, give me a figure of what growth you want, and I can prove the number one way or another, because I get the median house prices from people like CoreLogic, and it's almost 100 columns wide. So are you talking about secondhand? Are you talking about brand new? Are you talking inner city, CBD, outer city, houses, units, dwellings? You can prove any number you want. But look, I am a firm believer of property roughly doubling every 7, 10, 12 years. And as long as it doubles by, or as long as it goes up by, say, 1 to 3%. So really the way to work it out, if it's profitable for you, is what is the rent you're getting in? What is the mortgage less the cost? So say you're getting now 3.5% rent. Say your mortgage is 3%, but then you've got another 1 or 1.5% of expenses. You roughly need property to go up by 1 or 2% to break even. And as long as you can cash flow that negative 1 or 2%, you're in the money. And if it makes 3 or 4%, I'm happy. But if it makes 7, 8, 9, 10%, then even better.
Right. That's cool. Anything happening with your own personal portfolio? Any changes to that, if you want to share that?
Yeah, sure. So look, I'm trying to refinance at the moment. I've put some posts out recently that a lot of people's interest only is coming to expiry. I've rang a couple of my banks and I've managed to get, I think, one of my loan interest rates down 20%, another one about 12%. So on average, across about $10 million worth of debt, I've dropped it 16%. So I think that was a 75 grand saving. So look, even massive. If you haven't got 10 million of debt, you've got $1 million of debt, that would still be 7.5 grand a year, which is a holiday. So there's savings there. I'm trying to negotiate with my bank now to extend my interest only, to say that I'm not in hardship and I don't think I'll be in hardship, but to protect that, I want a forward plan. So if you change me to principal and interest in 12 months, you're going to double my mortgage repayments. Whereas if you extend my interest only, they'll stay the same and I can afford it. But the stupid thing is with our system is they've got to, even though I'm not pulling equity out, they'll still run me through credit checks to see if I can afford it, which doesn't make any logical sense, because say I pay 50 grand a month in mortgage repayments, they're saying, oh, you can't afford it, so we're going to double your repayments to 100 grand. But if you can afford it, we'll keep them at 50. It should be the other way around. You can't afford it, so we'll keep them at 50. But anyway, I'm playing with that logic with the banks.
How's that going for you so far?
Well, it's tough. And look, I've got 12 months to work on it. And obviously, I've got the money to afford the repayments. But obviously, I don't want to pay principal and interest if I don't have to. But I've managed to find a really, really nice woman in the retention department. So I go to the retention department rather than the hardship. And she understands the logic. Credit have obviously got a completely different opinion, and so she's doing her best, and I've thanked her a lot to try and find the right person in the bank that can say, we know this is the way it works. Chris has always been a bit different, as his mother always says, and so we need to try and do something different, because I'm a big customer, and if it goes wrong, it's not going to be good in the press for either of us. So why not work together to find a solution? Because I'm a profitable customer. I pay higher rates than most people. And so you want to keep me, then let's kind of extend the interest only.
Right. I think from memory, when we last had you on the podcast, you mentioned about some development projects that you were looking at, joint ventures kind of thing.
Yeah. So about a year ago, we raised a small fund. We got about 19 clients putting in 50 grand. So we raised about $1 million. And we were looking at property options in kind of Western Sydney. And the whole idea there, this is very much a high risk, could lose all your money type strategy. And so we only put it to clients that were reasonably wealthy, that could afford it. Almost like if you go and bet on 10.coms or 10 tech stocks, you might get one or two if you're lucky, and you might get nothing. And so we've been working that for a year, still very much a work in progress. It's probably a 3 to 4 year plan of trying to turn something around. And again, some of the other people in the syndicate have then disappeared, and they're going through COVID cash flow issues and stuff like that. So they've got capital back, not my clients, but the other people I was in the syndicate with. And so look, COVID could be the worst thing for us, but it could be the blessing in disguise. So the main thing is I'm still learning. I'm with a group of other people, and so we're all learning kind of shoulder to shoulder, and it's doing something different. But we're actually just looking at launching a new property fund as well, which is for the long-term buy and hold. And it's probably more for sophisticated or wholesale investors, just around legislation, because when you're dealing with retail, you need a lot more protection in there for them. And this is very much about long-term hold. So buying property, even if you can't service a mortgage, come and join a fund and together we'll do it. And rather than you've got an interest in half a property, you've maybe got a 5% interest across 10 or 20 or 30 properties. So it's diversified dollar cost average through COVID. So if COVID turns out to be a nightmare, it's great, then we've bought in well. And if nothing happens with COVID, well, we're buying in anyway, and we're in there for the long term. So, yeah, we're just going through drafts and stuff like that. But it's, look, it's exciting times. And whatever happens in the world, there's always an opportunity. So whether you're a business person or you're a first home buyer or whatever, there's opportunity. And it's only education and knowledge which is the difference between success and failure or sitting on the couch and doing nothing. So, again, people that listen to these type of podcasts and from various different people, that's how you gain your knowledge.
Yep. No, it's good. It's, there's a lot of different opinions that we are getting, obviously, from a lot of different people. Every investor has got their own story to tell, and every economist has got their own predictions, which is good.
Chris, what would you say for those people who are sitting on the sidelines at the moment? Because there's a lot of people just asking me, is it right time to buy? I don't know. I should sit on the sideline. I'm going to wait for another 3 to 6 months. What do you reckon?
Look, the people that sit on the sidelines, look, sometimes it's through no fault of their own, and it's confusing in the media with all these stories, but they always say if you do nothing, then you're going to get no results. At least if you try, you've given it a go. Mm-hmm. And so I've never timed the market. And I've bought in most of the time. I bought half my portfolio in the GFC, like the financial crisis back in kind of 2010 or so. My rule on buying for me or for my clients is buy when you've got the mortgage from the bank and you've got the cash deposit and you've got the cash buffer to hold on for the short to medium term, which is kind of 1 to 3 years or so, because no one can pick the market. So many people in 2019 weren't buying because they said, why buy now? Because I'll buy in 3 months because it's the market's going down. And no one would buy before the auction, before the election, even though logic said, because Labour were going to take away negative gearing, which meant buy before the election and it's grandfathered, so you're going to get that potentially for life. Whereas if you buy after the election, you might not get negative gearing. But still no one did it because they thought the market would crash with Labour. And on Monday morning at 9 o'clock after the election, the market changed and everyone missed the bottom. And then in February, it was hot as anything in the market and people were whinging, I missed the market, I've got to wait for the next one. And it's a cycle. We said the same thing on Sky in the GFC for 2 years. No one would buy. And it's madness. It's, if you think of it now, how many people are selling? Not that many, but there's still people selling. How many buyers are out there? There's virtually none. So is now a good time? It's got to be, because there's no buyers there. There's no competition.
Buy when there's blood on the streets, Warren Buffett.
Exactly. It's 101. It's so logical. And this is, I think this is my skill base, is I'm an accountant and I've got zero emotion.
Yeah.
That's so great for numbers. Investing.
Mm. So
not what, great for a marriage, but it's great for a profession.
So what's your prediction, Chris, for the next 18 months up until the end of 2021? Where do you see the property market to be? Do you want to be Steve Keen or you want to be Chris Joyce?
So, again, I mean, Chris Joyce is a good guy to follow because he's very intelligent. And it's not to say Steve isn't, but I think he just tells the market as it is. And he's not necessarily pro-property. He's a general economist and stuff. But look, I think the market's going to be okay depending on what market you're in. If you're in brand new high rises, it's going to be tough. But again, there's opportunity if you reckon you can read the market and you can buy low and kind of sell high or refinance high effectively. I've never tried to predict the market. Every time I buy, I'm buying for that 10 to 20 years. And so I don't know if my portfolio is going to grow today, tomorrow, in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And if anything, it's tough because say now the market's down. So my own personal portfolio, if I valued it now, it could be down 10 or 20% from the peak. But for my business as a buyer's agent, it's fairly good now because we've got a lot of buyers that are contrarian. When the market goes through a boom, it's great for my own personal wealth and portfolio because my property is growing, but it's really hard for the buyer's agency because we can't compete with all the emotional buyers. So almost no matter what happens, I'm winning on one hand or another. I'm either creating capital growth or I'm creating cash. And so that's a good diversification, almost like stocks and shares type thing. So because I haven't got a need to try and make a million overnight, I don't really care. And there's nothing I can do about it. And so why worry about stuff you can't control? So I put all my plan B, C's and D's in of having cash buffers, taking it out from the bank, from redraw, putting it with different banks to kind of hedge my bets. And it'll be what it'll be. But at least I'm very prepared because I'm heavily invested in the market. I'm controlling my costs through expenses and mortgage. And I'll take what the market gives me. But look, personally, I think it's going to be reasonably positive.
Okay. Different people will have different kind of buffers in place. But on a, what will you suggest if on a $1 million portfolio, right? What percentage should be of a $1 million portfolio should be a buffer? 1%, 2%? What's the amount?
Sure. And look, I've bounced in my 30 odd years from probably $10 buffer to maybe 1.5, 2 million or something. So it depends. And this is my motivator because I'm a good spender. So I spend all my money. I've got no money left. And so I feel pain. And so I go and work. And then I make lots of money. And then I go and invest it in property. And then I'm poor again. And that's my motivator. So at least you've got a motivator. That's the positive. But look, it depends on your negative gearing. So I think roughly on a $1 million portfolio, you're roughly going to probably lose 10 grand a year, depending on how highly you're geared. So I'd want to try and have 10 or 20 grand in my buffer. Now, when you've just got your first property, you're probably going to have no buffer because you're a first home buyer, you're 95% geared, and you're pushing the limits. And again, in a boom time, I'd almost have no buffer because I'd reinvested in more property. But at the same time, then I'd be gearing up for the downtimes because the market goes up and down, and to be then cashed up. So if you refinance every year, if COVID or something else happens the next day, ideally you would have refinanced within the last 12 months, which would have pulled as much equity as you can out.
Friends, $10 buffer is not a financial advice, and none of this is a financial advice.
Yeah, none of this is financial advice.
Chris is a professional in this space.
Yeah, just because I do it doesn't mean you should follow it. So don't go and get $10 million worth of debt tomorrow and cross your fingers it's going to be okay. So I've got very highly paid advisors. I've got big spreadsheets that I know to the dollar, and so it's a calculated risk. So I might go bust tomorrow, and everyone says, oh, Chris has failed. He didn't know what he was talking about. Yes, I did. I've pushed the limits, and I've got calculated risk, but there's always an element of risk, even in calculated risk.
Changing gears a little bit, Chris, moving away from property, some fun stuff. Aliens, believer or not?
Not if I'm sober, no.
You're drunk most of the times. Right. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
I almost bought into crypto. I was on a boat probably 2 years ago coming into Christmas with, I'm in a thing called the Entrepreneurs Organization, which is a whole bunch of business people, and everyone was on it. And I had a lot of cash then. And it was just that thing of the taxi drivers were talking about it. It's just like, you know, 100% you shouldn't get in, but I was still tempted. But the thing was, I thought, if I put 50 or 100 in and I double it, it's not going to change my life and it will really piss me off. And so unless I'm putting in $500,000 or $1 million, then it's not worth it. But there's no way I'd bet that big on something that I know is so volatile. So thank God I didn't do it and it crashed after that. So I just think I've just got to stick to property.
Maybe now no one's talking about it. No taxi driver talks about it. Now is the time to buy.
It could be the time to get in. Yeah. I've actually been doing a lot of reading recently, and a lot of the gurus are saying is sometimes the fear of losing money is much bigger than the pleasure of the gain. And I think for stuff like Bitcoin or shares, for me, that's definitely the thing. So I used to go to Randwick races on Melbourne Cup, and I bet $100. So 5 races, $20. But losing that $100 would really piss me off. Whereas if I went out for a long lunch and shouted a whole bunch of people and spent $1,000 on lunch and I came back fat and happy, I could see value in that. Whereas that $100, it still pisses me off, which is probably a good thing.
No, that's fair enough. Cool. Any thoughts on the money printing, QE?
Yeah, so look, I'm not a big economist and probably don't understand most of that to really have an opinion. Again, my thought is on most of this stuff is I leave it to the experts. And again, say the relation to property and how it might affect property. I listen to people like, say, Chris Joy, Louis Christopher from SQM Research, the guys at CoreLogic, because I think they're not hype economists and spokespeople. They say it like it is, and they're not afraid of saying it like it is. So if those guys are confident, then I'm pretty cool. And the main thing is I can hear stuff that's not in the media. So a lot of stuff, if it was that bad, we wouldn't talk about it in the media, I hate to tell you. So even like John Edwards from ResideX before, he was saying in one of the crises, I'm not going to tell anyone this, but I'm scared. But the bottom line is I wouldn't put it in the stock market because it's too scary. I wouldn't put it in cash because cash is a waste of time. So I'm still going to invest in property.
Fair enough. Mm. We published an episode last night on QEMMT with Steve Keen, and he thinks we are in headed towards depression. Any thoughts?
Yeah, look, again, without getting personal, I've heard of Steve Keen for 20 years, and he probably would make me go into a depression. Again, nothing personal. He's got his views, and his views are fine. I wouldn't have the brain or the economics background to be able to argue against him. But again, if you Google some of, I think Peter Switzer, who's a Sky presenter as well, I think he both had Chris Joy and Steve Keen on the same show. People can Google that. I mean, this was probably 3 months ago or so. You'd need a Peter Switzer or a Chris Joy to argue against that for whatever reasons they have.
That's cool. That's really good. That's all we had for the day. David, do you want to?
No, we're good.
Awesome. Chris, always, it's always fun to have you on the show, mate. I really enjoy it, to be honest. And I'm sure David does because he was pretty keen to bring you on too. But thanks for coming on the show. We'll probably bring you back at some point post-COVID to see how things are. And hopefully your Puma bull hat wins, as always. And everyone wins. That's all, mate.
Wonderful. Okay, thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, Bye. Chris.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.